Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Plenty packed in today's show. We'll be talking about England's squad announcement for their tour to South Africa later this month, the IPL, the Women's T20 Challenge, the WBBL, Babar Azam, and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by the Wisden Cricket Monthly staff writer, Jim Wallace, Wisden.com features editor, Tahir Hashim, and the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon. I'll refrain from mentioning the US election as much as possible today. It's completely ruined my sleep cycle this week, but I'll get one mention out of the way right at the top. There was a very funny tweet from Sky News' Mark Austin yesterday that read, "Never again can Americans mock cricket because it goes on for days with no clear winner." And I think it's fair to say that tweet had cut through.
Talking of cut through, Yaz, I got a couple of messages from friends congratulating me on that tweet that we did. I said, first of all, it wasn't our funny thing that we said in the first place. And also, I don't go anywhere near our social media accounts. But anyway, you're absolutely right. Cut through to at least two of my friends.
Yeah, I got a message, someone saying that was really funny. And I had the same response. It wasn't our joke.
All the best jokes are stolen. Also, I saw, Yaz, you had posted something. Did you post Trump declaring Pennsylvania or someone with the image of Shane Watson doing a tea review? I thought that was quite good. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me. We'll get on to Shane Watson later in the show.
Yeah, that's a really topical tweet. Nice.
You're getting good at this, Lark.
Anyway, England have announced their squad for their upcoming tour to South Africa. The main headlines, I guess, are Jofra Archer, Sam Curran and Ben Stokes have been rested for the ODI series. Liam Livingstone and Lewis Gregory, both uncapped in the ODI format, are in the ODI squad, as is Rhys Topley, who finds a spot in both squads. Ollie Stone is back in the ODI squad. And the reserves for both squads are Jake Ball, who is rewarded for a fine T20 Blast campaign, Tom Banton and Tom Helm of Middlesex. Tahir, what's your main takeaway from that squad announcement, if you have any?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing extraordinary that really stands out. There's not a sort of rogue pick in there. I thought it was just quite interesting to see Tom Banton down as a reserve. I feel like he's had a really tough time of it. Like it's kind of hard not to feel for him a bit. He's been carrying around the drinks in the IPL. Didn't have a great time of it in the two games he played. Obviously got some undeserved stick for actually going to the tournament. Now he's going to be carrying the drinks in South Africa on the sidelines. And then he's off to the Big Bash. Like, he is going to be absolutely knackered come the end of the year without having not actually played much cricket. Also quite interesting to see Jake Ball back in there after a couple of years. He'd sort of really fallen off the radar. Wasn't having a great time of it at Notts, but has had a really good T20 blast. So that's kind of it. There's no sort of kind of standout pick there. It's good to see Rhys Topley in there, because he's obviously bowled quite well for Surrey, played that one game against Ireland where he looked all right. And he's just a pretty good bowler who's, you know, not had the best of luck. So, I mean, that's really about it, really.
Yeah, Topley was the name that jumped out for me as well. I mean, he's still only 26, which is extraordinary given around how long he's been around for. But it's a great story that he's managed to come back. He had horrific injuries, lost his contract, was training on his own, multiple operations. It's actually a really good couple of pieces that Rob Johnston of CricBuzz did with him a few years ago when Topley didn't have a contract, and he took the time to meet up with Topley and to hear about his progress. And it's a really good example of the kind of the rubbish side of cricket that we don't often see. And the great thing with Topley is it's come full circle, and now he's back in the England setup, which he obviously was a few years ago. He's on only a white ball contract to Surrey, which is probably wise given his injury problems. Had a brilliant blast, loads of wickets. I think he was pretty much the most economical seam bowler in the competition. And he's got his chance, that left armour, obviously particularly useful in T20 cricket. And I think David Willey was unavailable for selection. So Topley gets his chance in both formats.
Mm. And Jim, there's no backup spinner to Adil Rashid in both squads, but I think more interesting in the T20 squad. Are you surprised by that? I know Moeen Ali is there, but he had an up and down white ball summer and isn't quite the same wicket-taking threat as Rashid. Do you think England should have at least looked to someone else in the event of an injury to Adil Rashid?
That is an area where they could come up short. I mean, they're probably relying on getting bits and pieces overs from the likes of Moeen Ali and who else turns their arm over? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. You put me on the spot.
Well, Joe Root in the 50 over side. Liam Livingstone is in the 50 over squad as well.
Are they possibly thinking that the wickets might not be that conducive to spin and they'll just try and get through by scratching through that way. Seems a bit of a risk, but I don't know. Have South Africa got more in their ranks?
I just think that obviously in a first choice team, Adebisi plays every time, but it's more in the event England goes to a T20 World Cup and Adebisi picks up an injury. I can't think of a decent T20 side ever really that, or sorry, in the last few years, that doesn't have a excellent wrist spinner. And England do have options there. Matt Parkinson has played a little bit for England and done quite well. Mason Crane, who played 3 years ago, had a really good summer, actually. I thought there was a chance that he'd come back into the fold. But I think, that is a real risk. If Adebisi picks up an injury, I don't know how England cover that.
I think they're nervous of the other. So Rashid, you know, he has control as a leg spinner to an extent, whereas the other two, they've done reasonably well when they've played, but they don't offer that same amount of control as a leg spinner or as a wrist spinner. Sorry, so the finger spinner, just, you know, trying to sneak through a few overs with a tweaker becomes a more appetising prospect.
And then they might have taken Liam Dawson, possibly, who wasn't available through injury. And when I listened in on that, the press conference with Ed Smith after that squad announcement, he said the door was still very much open for Dawson and Joe Denley as well, as two players I think that they trust. They don't necessarily feel like they need to see much more of them. But he said if there was an opportunity or a chance came up and there was a big tournament around the corner, they wouldn't think twice about putting them in for that. And I think that's probably why they've gone down this route. But it does seem, I agree, I think it's strange not to have a young spinner there to at least potentially get a crack, especially if England have already won a series and you've got a dead rubber. It seems like a good opportunity with big tournaments around the corner to get a bit of big match experience.
I found that quite interesting with Liam Dawson in particular, because he's not actually played much cricket for England, which you kind of just assume that he's played 20, 30 ODIs maybe, but what's it, three ODIs, I think? Might be wrong.
Created some impression in those very few opportunities, though, that England basically trust him enough to not see him for 4 years, but they trust him enough to still pick him for the World Cup when it eventually comes round.
He must be great in the changing room, I think, is the phrase, yeah.
Joe, you mentioned that there was no place for Joe Denley in the squad. Now, that might not come as much of a surprise, but Denley was involved with a lot of the white ball action in the summer. You spoke to him before the squad announcement. Did you get the sense that he was someone who was aware that his international career might be coming to an end and his chances minimising?
Not necessarily. I think he's not naive. He knows his age. He's 34 now, counts against him. But he said he absolutely hasn't written off Test cricket. He, again, appreciates that Zach Crawley has certainly nailed down that spot. But I think he's still hopeful of a squad place with lots of Test cricket ahead. He said the Ashes is still a big target for him. I think one day cricket, I think he was more hopeful. He'd already lost his white ball contract, which is obviously was an ominous sign. But I think given the lack of spin options, I think he still would have fancied his chances as going as a kind of backup batsman who's also useful for a few overs. And it's worth remembering, I mean, it feels a very long time ago now, but his last two ODIs were in South Africa earlier this year, and he scored 87 and 66. So whilst there'll be a lot of people out there who say, God, Denny should never have been near the one-day side in the first place, well, when he's been in it, he's actually done okay. And it's probably age counting against him here. They've gone for Liam Livingstone, who I think is 27. He's a more dynamic batsman, which is probably what they want in that role. But I believe Ed Smith when he says the door isn't closed on Denley, just because I know how much England think of him. And if there is a spot that needs filling, he won't be too far from the top of the queue.
I can't believe that South Africa series was this year.
I know, it's ridiculous. I have to check it literally every single time I refer to it because I can't believe it was this year.
Yeah, that Cape Town test where England took three late wickets, that was in 2020.
I remember watching that in the office. Those are the days.
Oh, the office.
well, here is a small snippet from that conversation between Joe and Joe Denley. Joe's full feature on Denley will be going up on wisdom.com later this week.
Do you feel like you're still in the mix for these winter squads, all being well and the tour's going ahead?
I'd like to think so, yeah. Look, I've met up with Ed and I know there's a couple of areas that I need to work on within my game. And I also understand that there's a lot of good young players around that have been pushing their case throughout the summer, whether it be playing with their counties or opportunities that they've got with England Lions or you know, opportunities in warm-up games with England. There's some good young players around. So, yeah, look, it's going to be tough to force my way back into the side. And, you know, they might go with a bit of, you know, younger generation, if you like. Although I hope that's, you know, not the case. I'm still consider myself to be, you know, very fit. And like I say, that ambition's still there. So, yeah, I know I'm quite realistic as well. It's going to be tough, but there's a lot of cricket to be played. Certainly before that Ashes series, I know there's India and Sri Lanka tour, Test tour in the new year, which hopefully I can be a part of. I know they've spoken about squads potentially being a bit larger, in terms of being in players coming in and out of the bubble and stuff like that. So yeah, I still consider myself certainly to be in the running for a Test squad spot, and the chats I've had with Ed and Chris Silverwood and Ruti, when I lost my place, was the door certainly wasn't shut. So yeah, that gives me a bit of confidence as well.
If you do get another crack at it, is there anything you would do differently next time? I mean, obviously it's a given you'd want that big score, but is there anything in terms of your approach that you'd do differently?
Yeah, I think I found myself certainly in the Test I played, I felt really comfortable at the crease, and batted for long periods of time without really scoring at a good rate. And I think that's one area that I need to try and look at is as much as being, you know, solid and batting time, it's about accumulating runs and being tougher to bowl at in that area, trying to have more scoring options, working the singles, working twos, and stuff like that. And you know, the best players do that. And, you know, Ruchi is one of the best at that. You'll look up at the scoreboard and he'll be 20 off 20 balls. And, you know, whereas I found myself 20 off 60, 70 balls. So, yeah, I think just working on becoming harder to bowl at in that regard, and having more scoring options, certainly. I suppose being a bit more positive in everything I'm doing there. And with spin as well. And, you know, I found myself getting through really tricky periods against high quality bowling and seeing off the new ball. And then when that spin bowler comes on, it's really taking the chance to up the scoring rate and be positive against the spin, which is something I don't think I did particularly well in the Test matches that I played. So there are a couple of areas that I would like to try and improve on going forward.
That story started doing the rounds. I think I first heard Kevin Peterson say it during the South Africa tour that you were kind of being specifically asked to bat for 100 balls by the team management, that was kind of your primary goal. Is there any truth in that?
No, they were very clear on scoring heavily first innings, and they weren't too worried about how we did it. And at no stage I was told that I had to face 100 balls. You know, with batsmen at the end of the day, you just go out and score runs. It doesn't matter how you do it. And it may have looked like that some innings that I played where I got a bit bogged down and was just looking to bat time. But no, I wasn't ever told just to go out and make sure I face 100 balls.
Is it frustrating when you see those, you know how rumours spread on social media, it's kind of like a school playground. Is it frustrating to see that when you think that's just not even the case?
Social media can be frustrating, full stop. There's a lot of things that go around that aren't necessarily true, and I suppose that's one of the challenges of playing at the top level, is what's written in the media, social media and stuff like that. You're going to get a lot of negative, I suppose, stories floating around, and you have to, I suppose, deal with those. And that's part and parcel of it. I think Zach Crawley's probably a sensible lad. He hasn't got Instagram or Twitter or anything like that, so he doesn't have to read it all. And I do actually find myself coming off social media quite a bit when I'm involved with England, just to try and stay clear of it, really, and deal with it that way.
Yeah, I mean, you always seem to take these things in your stride and be very laid back about it, but I did wonder, after so many years on the county circuit where you're kind of universally loved by Kent fans, is it an unsettling experience to find yourself under such scrutiny? Because you kind of inadvertently became quite a divisive figure in that lots of people really appreciated the job you were doing. Other people didn't think you were quite cut out for it. Is that quite, can that be an unsettling experience?
Well, certainly it can. I think I'm a lot better equipped to deal with it. I think that is something certainly I struggled with early on in my career when I first played for England, when I was in my early 20s. And I knew, sort of going back into the setup, I was going to be, there were going to be people that weren't my biggest fans. And but yeah, it's I suppose, you know, I can say that I deal with it now quite easily and sort of part and parcel of it. But of course, I think it does have an effect. And when you read it and it becomes more often, you know, you're reading it in press and on social media, it can have an effect. And yeah, I think it's you know, something we just have to deal with.
Do you have concerns with some of your younger teammates? I mean, Joffre spoke about it in the summer that it was actually having quite an effect on him. I don't know what the answer is really, but do you have concerns for some of those younger players who haven't got the experience that you have to lean on?
I do actually. Yeah, that's something I have thought about. These young guys that are starting out their international careers or even county careers, and you know, some of the stuff that you get on social media is you know, quite disgusting, really. I suppose it's your choice. Would you choose to have those platforms? And you know, a lot of it is positive, and it's great for these guys to share their stories of what they're up to and you know, how things are going. But I suppose at the same time, there's always going to be that negative side of it. And there are, you know, we are very lucky to have the support networks that travel around with us for the England side, and quite an open group as well. And you know, there's always people to talk about if you are struggling with those issues. But yeah, I think certainly people that are quite negative, you know, there's past players I know that use Twitter to, there's a few past players that I know that aren't my biggest fans that, quite often put it on their Twitter accounts and stuff like that. It's disappointing to see, you know, when they played, you know, social media wasn't so big, so they didn't really have to deal with it. So, you know, I would question whether they're actually thinking about the effect that all these tweets and stuff that they put out, how far that travels. That is one question that maybe they could think about.
Moving on to the IPL, there was a brilliant end to the group stages with 6 of the 8 teams in contention for a playoff spot going into that final weekend. Sunrisers Hyderabad eventually nabbed that final spot with a win over league leaders Mumbai Indians, who were resting a few players. So guys, bearing in mind that this show will be going out after the first qualifier for the final between Mumbai and Delhi, I'll be asking you a little bit about how you think the IPL will go. But first off, Joe, we discussed on our IPL preview video about how the move from Trevor Bayliss and David Warner to drop Johnny Bairstow has proved pivotal for Sunrisers.
Absolutely has. First of all, I should say for regular listeners, I have got my TVs fixed, so I'm not winging it. I have actually watched some of what I'm talking about here. But yeah, with the Sunrisers, who oddly kind of go into the playoff stages as the form team, and that move to drop Bairstow, which seemed a bit controversial because he hadn't had a bad IPL, hadn't been brilliant, but hadn't been bad, to bring in Holder in that middle order, bolster their bowling options, and then put Ridham and Sahar up as an opener has absolutely paid off in every single way that it could have done. And it's made them look a much more rounded outfit. And they were way too top heavy previously. And with Rashid Khan, who is basically unhittable and taking wickets, they suddenly look like a really well-balanced side that could potentially go all the way. They've obviously got to do it the hard way. They've got to win 3 matches to get there. But I think I wouldn't be at all surprised if we have a Mumbai Indians Sunrisers final come the end of it.
They made short work of... So Kolkata, I had Kolkata in a sweepstake and they set 150 and they made short work of that the other day. So Mumbai had rested... Bumrah and a few others as well, but
Trent Bolt as well, I think.
Yeah, but they look like they're hitting form just at the right time.
And also RCB and Delhi Capitals, the teams that finished second and third, are woefully out of form. They both kind of crawled to the playoffs, got to the playoffs on the back of brilliant early season form. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Sunrisers got to the final.
Isn't that the quirk of the IPL, the fact it goes on so long that teams can sort of get into form and out of form because it goes on for, you know, half a year or something, that, you know, they were in form and now they've sort of played. It's almost like when you're batting, you start off in good nick and you just sort of scratch around for so long that you end up playing yourself out of form. So, yeah, it's what are we going to do when the IPL finishes?
Well, that's why I was really sort of fascinated by the whole Kings 11 story, you know, one win from seven, and then they win five on the bounce, and I'm like, okay, they could actually do this now because they've sorted out their team, everything's going well, but then they sort of bottled it at the end, but it was just I had a look at the IPL league table after it all finished. I was just sort of in shock in a way to see Rajasthan Royals right at the bottom because they'd been kind of in with a shout right till the end. Jofra was amazing, but. And then CSK had somehow climbed away from bottom. So it's been quite fascinating to see that and what the points difference is. Well, Sunrisers finished on 14, right? KKR finished on 14 with Sunrisers, and yet they don't make it. And then the bottom two teams have 12 points. So it's been a pretty fascinating tournament.
Joe, were you saying you've put a flutter on?
Well, I put £3, all of £3 on Rajasthan Royals about 12 hours before they got knocked out of the competition. But I thought if they could sneak through, all they had to do was beat Kolkata Knight Riders and hope Mumbai Indians beat Sunrisers, and then they'd have been there. And they just have so many good players. I thought they could have gone on a three-game streak in the eliminator rounds to do it. But obviously, not this year. Their bowling was just, without Archer, was just nowhere near good enough. Yaz, you put a stat up there of comparing the rest of the Rajasthan attack to Archer, which didn't take a genius to work out why they hadn't qualified.
I think it was specifically the pace attack with Archer versus the rest of the pace attack. I don't have it in front of me, but from memory, it was Archer went at less than 7. The rest of the pace bowlers went at more than 10. I think the rest of the pace attack had a combined average of about 50. Archer's was under 20. But Jim, Mumbai have just been the best team by quite a long way. Do you see them as the favourite still?
I do. I think they're going to do. I think they've just... they've been in form the entire time. They seem a settled side. And also, again, going back to my own stupid little life, my older brother has them in the sweepstake and he's a jammy little so-and-so, so I'm pretty certain that they will they'll take the crown.
Yeah, it's just that they're, the number of brilliant domestic players they have at their disposal, a lot of whom haven't actually played for India, like Rahul Chahar, Suryakumar Yadav, Kunal Pandya, Ishan Kishan looks brilliant. Wisden India's Adia Sharma said about a year ago that he rated Kishan at a similar level to Pant, and they're the same age. I remember kind of scoffing at him, thinking that was ridiculous, but Kishan has been absolutely brilliant.
It shows how a team can be formed from, you know, if you look at the lineups, then you wouldn't pick them as the sort of gun lineup. You'd perhaps go for someone like Rajasthan or these teams that have sort of the bigger names, but although they do have a couple of big names, obviously they perform as a team a bit more than some of the others. They sort of less rely on their big star signings.
I think at this point of the tournament, you just look at the crucial positions like the finisher, and you would back Pollard to get them over the line more often than not. And Mumbai Indians have won a couple of absolute squeakers over the last few years, and with Bumrah and Bolt up top, I think have taken more than 40 wickets between them in the tournament. They are going to be tough to beat, unless they've already been beaten by Delhi Capitals, in which case they're actually quite easy to beat.
So, related to the IPL, Shane Watson has announced his retirement from the professional game this week. In England, where we didn't really take notice of white ball cricket until 2015, Watson was a bit of a joke figure sometimes. Like, he was known for his LBW troubles and erratic use of DRS. But in all seriousness, he's a genuine limited overs legend.
Well, I think he's one of the most fascinating cricketers of this century, really. I don't think that's at all an exaggeration. At test level, his record is by no means terrible, but he never really cracked it. There was sort of this air of desperation to succeed there whenever he was at the crease. I'll never forget his celebration against England when he hit a ton at Perth in that 5-0 whitewash, sort of arms aloft, puff of the cheeks. So almost a sense of relief over actual joy. But his body seemed to let him down there. But in white ball cricket, he had sort of more of a confident swagger, total colossus. You know, 2 World Cup medals, twice man of the match in the Champions Trophy finals, absolutely bossed the IPL, won franchise leagues, left, right, and centre. I can't remember, he's turned himself into a T20 great. And so it's been a really extraordinary career, really. He, you know, I get that he's almost a bit of a figure of fun with the whole review thing and that. And that's almost what will be sort of the enduring image of his test career is making the T sign with his bat. But he was so much more than that. And, you know, I think you guys spoke on the podcast a few weeks ago about Australia's, you know, search for a great all-rounder. They've searched for a great all-rounder for years. You know, Shane Watson was in one ways not that, but also that, you know. He did kind of crack it. And has had a pretty extraordinary career that most cricketers would, you know, kill for.
Joe, I watched the Watson's retirement video. We kind of talked to camera about his career and about the decision. And one thing that he referenced was how amazed that he was in himself that he got to 39 still playing elite level cricket despite all the struggles he had with his body. How do you think we should remember Watson's career?
The longevity is amazing. In some ways, it's his greatest achievement given the troubles he did have. I think he should be remembered as an absolutely top class white ball batsman. I think the all-rounder thing has kind of muddied the waters. I don't think he was ever going to be a genuinely brilliant all-rounder. His bowling was never quite good enough, partly because his body didn't allow him to be. And it's almost been a rod for his own back in that he's been judged against that all-rounder benchmark. And that's just not really what he's been for the vast majority of his career. He's also an interesting character because I interviewed him quite a few years ago at the GM factory when one of the Ashes tours over here. And he was really lovely, like a really, really nice man. And that didn't shock me hugely. I'd heard he was a nice man, but he didn't kind of have an aura about him in some ways. And the way that if you meet Ben Stokes, who's also a nice man, it is like he just dominates the room. And even though Watson's a big man, it wasn't like that at all. He was quite soft-spoken and
there's a melancholiness to Watson, I've always thought. He's sort of like a big sad scarecrow, like lumbering in and his body always sort of seeming like it might give out on him. And that's the thing with the all-rounder thing. He didn't look like he took any pleasure in bowling whatsoever. He was sort of creeping to the crease and that even when he was a younger man. But yeah, so it's interesting you say about him not having an all or being really nice, because wasn't he known for being, didn't he have some beef with Australian management with the homework thing, and also with Michael Clarke over the years? They sort of didn't see eye to eye. So
there were fallouts. I think probably, I mean, he's had a long career. Those were in his younger days. I'm sure he's mellowed a lot, as most players do, as Stokes has done already. But I think Tyler's right in when he says that England fans have probably got a warped view of how good he is, because we just think of him being out LBW for 30-odd in a Ashes Test match. But obviously, his career suggests, and it is certainly the case, that he was a much, much better player than that.
There's been a bit of international cricket this week. Pakistan and Zimbabwe contested a 3-match ODI series. It's part of the new Cricket World Cup Super League, where every match counts towards World Cup qualification in 2023. It was a great series, actually. So Pakistan survived the scare in the first ODI, where a Brendan Taylor 100 from Zimbabwe took them close to chasing 280. The second one was more straightforward, as Pakistan chased down 207 with 15 overs to spare. But the third one was an absolute classic, going to a super over. So Pakistan was struggling in pursuit of 279, but a brilliant Babar Azam 100 and an enterprising half century odd from Wahab Riaz down the order kept them in it. But then came Northamptonshire's blessing Musrabani. Musrabani took 4 late wickets to finish with a fifer and leave Pakistan needing 13 off the last over with just 1 wicket in hand. Pakistan's numbers 10 and 11, Mohammad Musa and Mohammad Hasnain, who had earlier taken a fifer, scrambled 8 from the first 5 balls in the over, which left them needing 5 off the last ball. Musa nails one straight to short cover, who lets it go straight through him, and it races away to the fence. And then we go to a super over, just a second super over in the history of ODI cricket. No prizes for guessing what was the first one. And then Musrabani takes 2 wickets and concedes just 2 runs from the Pakistan super over. where Pakistan interestingly sent out Iftikhar Ahmed and Kushdil Shah, who's on debut. That didn't really work. Then Zimbabwe chased three with a couple of balls to spare. A really good series. All of it was streamed on YouTube, so very easy to watch if you're in the UK. Annoyingly, there were adverts mid-over, which is not a good thing when it's a super over. But a brilliant game of cricket and a brilliant series as well. But anyway, related to Pakistan cricket, Taha, your street cred and your family WhatsApp group is through the roof right now. Do you want to explain why?
Oh, well, this is for the next issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. I interviewed Shoaib Akhtar today, which was quite surreal. Someone who I sort of watched growing up, fastest bowler of all time. It was just a bit of it was one of those experiences where you kind of have to remind yourself to keep it professional and not be like, oh yeah, I've watched it all my life. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Do you have an aura to her?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, he certainly does. So that was, yeah, that was quite an experience. I don't want to give too much away about the interview, but some great bits on just how painful it was bowling fast. He sort of reeled off the exact number of injections he had over his career. I won't delve into it too much, but the family WhatsApp group is popping.
Well, anyway, we can look forward to that in the next issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. Yesterday, the Women's T20 Challenge got underway in the UAE. We're two games in, and they've been very interesting for different reasons. The first one was an absolute thriller. It went down to the penultimate ball with South Africa's Sune Lewis hitting a fine 37 not out of 21 balls to see her side over the line. The very next day, Velocity, the side who won the first game, were then bundled out for just 47 against the Trailblazers, with Sophie Eccleston running through their top order, taking just 4 for 8, which is pretty handy. We've talked about it briefly on the show before, but I think it's a real shame that the tournament is so short. I mean, like, one freak innings like that represents a considerable chunk of the tournament, and players have had to, you know, go to bubbles, etc., for very little cricket. And I kind of think that there are so many IPL game days with just one game. You could so easily pack in more double headers with women's games potentially earlier in the day at another venue or the same venue. I don't know what anyone else thinks about that.
A full women's IPL is just a matter of time. It's inevitable. But I would have thought it would have arrived by now. And I've been told for the last couple of years by various people within the game that, oh, it's just about to happen. And it hasn't happened for whatever reason, whether that's the desire to support women's cricket in India isn't quite there. I mean, it's improved massively, but it's still obviously lagging way, way behind the men's. So it absolutely needs to be bigger than it is. There's always that debate whether tagging women's cricket onto the end of men's is a good thing to do. Women's cricket in general was kind of moved beyond that. But then maybe the IPL is a different case. Maybe that is the best way to promote it initially, and then you build up that popularity and then it can stand in its own right. But I think the pandemic, obviously, again, won't have helped, as it hasn't helped anything. But it's probably probably held back the women's IPL for at least another year, which is a shame. But it will arrive, and it will be great.
So yeah. Short, isn't it? It's only they're playing three games each in a week, and you have to do a full quarantine. So thinking, is it Danny Wyatt's the other? So Sophie Eccleston's doing really well. Danny Wyatt, I think, has batted twice, got single digit scores, but probably had to do a full couple of weeks of quarantine. It just seems like ridiculously short for the amount of sort of pain that you have to go through to play in it. I don't know why that is,
especially when we've just talked about how the men's IPL has dragged on quite a bit as well.
Yeah, they need it's a tricky one. You don't want to make it seem like it's an afterthought, but you would have thought that if they're going to put it on, that it would at least be longer than it has been.
The WBBL is underway. We'll go into a bit more depth on it next week. England's Heather Knight is going very well at the moment. But given that the next magazine is a pace special, I thought it was worth talking about one player who's caught the eye so far. So young Darcy Brown, who's sharing new ball duties with Megan Shute, is genuinely very quick. She bowled a spell the other day. She's only 17. She bowled a spell the other day that Didn't quite hit 80 miles per hour, but was very close on a few occasions. Joe, you've seen her bowl a little bit via some YouTube highlights. You've been impressed?
Yeah, I saw a couple of clips. She was swinging it as well. Looks like Australia might have found another one, which is obviously not good news from an England supporters' point of view, but it's fantastic news for women's cricket, which has traditionally lacked genuine pace. Often the spinners do such a fantastic job, it's tempting just to stick with that kind of more conservative option. But there is a sign as the women's game becomes more dynamic, more aggressive, that fast bowlers obviously are perfectly in keeping with that, and there's a desire to get more quicks into the teams. I think because they're effective, and that they're effective in all cricket, and that shouldn't be any different in women's cricket. And B, but there is also the spectacle to think of as well, and people love watching fast bowling. People love watching a variety of bowling, and women's cricket has sometimes lacked that. So it's really good that Australia have got a couple coming through. We've got one over here in England as well, Izzy Wong, who's only 18 years old. I spoke to this morning for the magazine that you're talking about. She's been clocked at, I think, 72 miles an hour, but is only 18 and hasn't had a full summer of cricket yet, really. So she is being talked about as a potential kind of 80 mile an hour bowler, and has already been training with England full side. And I think come 2022, when England got a World Cup and a T20 World Cup and a Commonwealth Games, all being well, Izzy Wong will be massively part of those squads and is the kind of successor to Catherine Brunt.
No pressure. We started the pod with a tweet, and we're going to end the pod with a tweet too. So there is a Twitter account called Fesshole, which allows Twitter users to post anonymous confessions to the account's 91,000 plus audience. And that account had a message from someone claiming to be a former England cricketer. So we're going to do a bit of detective work to try and work out who this might be. The tweet read, I'm a retired professional cricketer who managed to play a handful of times for England. Although I did my best for them, it was just a job for me. I support another national team quite fervently and secretly always want England to lose. Jim, any guesses for who you reckon that might be? A lot of Twitter users instantly presumed it must be someone not born in the UK, which I'm not sure about.
No, I didn't go down that route. I went old school, as is often the case with me. I thought it might be Roger Prideaux. just because he sounds a bit French, and also I think he emigrated to South Africa. So, and he only played a handful of tests. Another one that came to me was Tim Munton, only played a couple of tests. But yeah, I just like to think of the sort of.
On what basis have you gone with Tim Munton?
Just, you know, I like the thought of him sort of downloading Twitter during lockdown 2 and being like, oh, I'll just give this a go and finding this a thing, and then just sort of bearing his soul on Fesshole. Is it called Fesshole? Sounds a bit awful, but yeah. I saw a few people doing, you know, it was Ed Smith and things like that. I don't know, I like to think it's one of those old geezers who's come to terms with his place in English cricket history.
Yeah, so I tried to do some genuine detective work here. I was hoping that there'd be a prominent former England cricketer who follows the account, and I couldn't find any. The only cricketer I found... Actually, no, that's not true. There were two cricketers I found who follow this account. One of them was Oliver Hannan-Dolby, who has not yet played for England, so it's not him. The other one was Graham Swann, who I really don't think it is. I don't think Graham Swann would refer to his career as having just managed to have played a few games or a handful of games for England. A lot of people thought it was Nick Compton, and again, for the same reason, I don't think it's Nick Compton. I don't think Nick Compton would refer to his career in that way, and I also don't think it was ever just a job for Nick Compton. Joe Tahar, any other guesses?
One that came to mind was Darren Pattinson, but yeah. Handful, he only played the once, didn't he? So I think that's probably not right. And then we were discussing, I mean, Robert Croft has been mentioned by a few people on Twitter.
He's been outed by a few people, hasn't he?
It depends on, I mean, what's a handful? Robert Croft played, for me, played more than a handful of games.
Yeah. Could be false modesty?
Is what, sorry, false modesty? Yeah, possibly.
Tahar's very quiet, he's not giving it any thought at all.
It's me.
Anyway, if you've got any guesses for who team that might be or any comments about anything else in the show, feel free to get in touch with any of us on Twitter.
Can we do a Twitter poll, Yaz, Munton versus Prido, and see what the public think? I think that's really who it's down between.
Just those two, or are we going to open it?
I think it's nailed on those two, yeah. It's the great next race after Trump versus Biden.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anyway, thanks, Sahar, Joe and Jim. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Thanks for listening, folks. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend? And if you're feeling especially kind, why not leave a complimentary review on the podcast app? Cheers.